Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome once again to Connecting Faith. It's always great to have you along. Appreciate you taking some time to listen. And today's program will be an important discussion. I want to encourage you to stay tuned for as much as you can. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls, and our focus today is on a very important topic. It's a topic of justice, and thankfully that's an area where many Christians have become much more interested in and passionate about, and we're going to hear today where there's a great need and an opportunity. So stay tuned to Connecting Faith. We're going to talk about a plague today. I don't know if you've had your shots. This is
a little immunization. Huh?
This is one of those cases where I think we would love to be immunized from the reality of this, but it is like as the title of the book suggests, the locus effect. Back in the late 1800s, and has been several times, of course, over the course of history. But when the locusts descend, and they pretty much take up everything in their path, and that is sort of what we're going to be talking about today. This is the book that we're going to reference is called The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. And we'll hear from my guest today, who has co-authored the book. Victor Boutros is a federal prosecutor who investigates and tries nationally significant cases of police misconduct, hate crimes, and international human trafficking around the country on behalf of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's also a member of the Justice Department's Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit, which consolidates the expertise of some of the nation's top human trafficking prosecutors and enhances the federal government's ability to identify and prosecute large human trafficking networks. He has worked with International Justice Mission and gotten to know Gary Haugen over the years. And Gary and Victor wrote this book together. And by the way, Victor is speaking us today in his personal capacity, not as a member of the Justice Department. So we just want to acknowledge that right at the beginning. Victor, welcome to Connecting Faith. It's an honor to have you on today.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This book, it's talking about the violence that affects so much of our globe. And it made me it almost made me ill, and certainly ill at ease. And I'm wondering if that's maybe the idea, the kind of the reaction you were hoping for when you wrote the book.
Well, it's one of these. One of the things about this plague is that it's so hard for us to see. You know, I think back to when Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, and he sets the story on this Jericho road that's so familiar to Jesus and all his followers as this place of lawless violence with all these caves. People come out in ambush. Probably many of the hearers, maybe even the law expert himself, had witnessed people who had been assaulted or maybe even been assaulted themselves. This world of violence was the world that Jesus entered and chose to enter, and that those who knew him and those who lived in that community were very familiar with. But in our world today, especially as Americans, we're generally so privileged to get to live in relatively safe places that we don't even come across the Jericho Road. We don't actually see the lawless violence that happens in our midst unless we actually go out and look for it. And even those who do go to the developing world and who are sophisticated travelers there, when they call to mind what sort of images of the poor, they might visually picture, you know, maybe distended stomachs and hunger, maybe the shanty houses and poor housing, maybe sickness and disease. But typically what does not come to mind is violence. And yet that is what the poor themselves describe as the most fundamental problem that confronts them on a daily basis. So part of the vision of the book was to take readers where our Lord spends so much of his time, with the poor who are victims of violence. And there's just sort of personally the sense that, for me, that if I really want to know God more deeply, I need to understand where he's been. And part of that means drawing near to some of these painful places where he spends his time, and that is with the poor who are victims of violence. And so that's part of the effort of the book, is to take people into this hidden world of everyday violence as a way of both knowing God more deeply and connecting with those whom he loves so much.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the, not only the fact that there is violence, but how the system in so many cases, or the systems, are completely broken and counterproductive in many cases. But maybe we need to expand on, you know, what are we talking about when you talk about lawless violence? I mean, I think you, obviously we mentioned in the title that you're part of the working in human trafficking prosecution. I guess we probably assume that's part of it. But you discuss, chapters worth. So maybe just a little summary. What are we talking about here?
Well, it's something that's hard for us to understand here in the United States, because we're so used to just breathing the invisible oxygen of law enforcement protection that's hidden from view. It's sort of like when you take a vaccine, the vaccine is sort of out of sight, out of mind. You don't quite think about it. And yet constantly the vaccine is in the background working to destroy these hidden forces within your body that could otherwise destroy your body. And likewise, we've had that sort of same experience of having this invisible oxygen of law enforcement that's almost hidden from view, that's constantly protecting us from human forces and impulses of violence that would otherwise come in, and especially for those of us who are weaker or more vulnerable, make us susceptible to violence. And yet this is the reality for most of the poor in the world. The UN said that there are about 4 billion people who live outside the protection of law, which sounds like just sort of this mind-numbing large statistic, but it's actually this profound reality for the poor, that it's like there's just no law enforcement in their area. And for me, this really came home in a more personal way a little over a year ago, when the story popped up of this woman in Oregon who had been assaulted by this man in her community, and she'd actually been hospitalized by him. And now, a couple of weeks later, she's in her home, it's dark, it's a weekend night, and this same man comes to her door and starts trying to rip through her window to break into her home. And she calls 911, as we all would do, terrified of what's about to happen. And she calls, and there's this sort of terrifying and disturbing 911 call where the 911 operator explains to her that because of town budget cuts, law enforcement now only are able to work on the weekdays. But this is a weekend. And so she says, "I'm just so sorry, but there's just no law enforcement in your area." And it's this just tragic phone call where she says, "I could, maybe give you some advice and have you call the sheriff on Monday. Can you ask him to leave?" And it goes on and on. And sadly, this man actually does rip through her window and tragically assaults and chokes and rapes this woman. And you see that in the wake of this episode, crime just spikes in this area. And this is just in our own country in rural Oregon. And for me, that just so powerfully brought home the way in which these invisible forces of law enforcement restrain the hand of violence. And when it's not there, the protections fall away and the hand of violence descends on us. And so that is really what this is about. It's not that the poor in the developing world don't get laws. They do. For the most part, they get really good laws. What they don't get is what the rest of us get, and that is law enforcement.
Whether it's human trafficking, the rapes and assaults, the sexual assault, but there are others things too. I hadn't really thought about. Obviously, I think we've talked about slavery as well, those that are sort of forced into slavery. But even losing your land and property, that's just sort of common thuggery, isn't it?
Yeah, we talk about in the book these sort of 4 categories of everyday criminal violence. And the reason why we say everyday criminal violence is because we want to distinguish it from the violence that sort of makes its way into the headlines of our newspapers, the mass atrocities and genocides and civil wars and rebellions. These are the things that we will, you know, we'll open the Washington Post and read about on our in our Sunday newspaper. But the kind of violence that we describe in the book is the kind of thing that actually never makes the headlines, because it's just so common. It's just everyday criminal violence. And for the poor, it's so common that it's almost unremarkable. And we talk about four categories of everyday violence. One is gender violence. This is sexual abuse and domestic violence, mostly of women and girls in the developing world. We talk about a second category, which is forced labor or slavery. And this is not a metaphor for something that's bad like slavery is bad. This is actual literal slavery that's happening today in the 21st century. The Global Slavery Index came out last year and said that there are 30 million slaves in the world today, which is more than all the slaves in 400 years of the transatlantic slave trade. That was an arresting fact when I first learned it. And then the third category of everyday violence is police abuse. The police in the developing world are often the greatest source of criminal violence in the poor's lives. In the developing world, when you're poor and you're in trouble, you don't run to the police, you actually run from the police. And so we talk about the way that that devastates the hope of the poor. And then the fourth category of everyday violence is, as you said, predatory land grabbing. This is the way that, you know, for most of the poor, the most significant asset, researchers tell us, for them to climb their way out of poverty is just a little piece of land where they're able to have a little shelter and grow some food that they can then use to sustain themselves and maybe to sell and make a little money to sustain their lives. And what happens in the developing world is that in the absence of any law enforcement protection, the bullies in the community will just come and steal the land away and kick people off their land. And one of the most vulnerable groups to this form of violence are widows, which collectively support a half a billion orphans in the developing world today. And so they find themselves kicked off their land and therefore without a place of shelter and without a place of sustenance for them.
We're talking about the locust effect, why the end of poverty requires the end of violence. Now, many of us are perhaps hopefully supporting some sort of maybe it's a child sponsorship. We're involved in you know, great ministries that provide food for hungry people and medical health care, perhaps sponsoring missionaries that are doing those kinds of work. And the fact is that there is this underlying issue of violence that needs to be addressed. And in a moment, we'll talk about why and how that can be addressed and what some of the problems are in these broken systems. Victor Boutros is a federal prosecutor. He investigates and tries nationally significant cases of police misconduct, hate crimes, and international human trafficking around the country. On behalf of the U.S. Justice Department, he has co-authored the book with Gary Haugen from International Justice Mission called The Locust Effect. More in a moment.
Stay tuned. More of the best of Connecting Faith in just moments. Back now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired encore presentation.
Give me your eyes for just 1 second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing.
The book, The Locust Effect, is one of the more unsettling books that you will read. It's just out from Gary Haugen and Victor Boutros. It's published by Oxford University Press, and it is a sobering documentation of the plague that affects much of the world's poor, common violence. Become routine and relentless, and like a horde of locusts devouring everything in its path, the unchecked plague of violence ruins lives, blocks the road out of poverty, and undercuts developments. We made a lot of progress in development, but there's obviously a lot of work to be done. Victor is part of the U.S. Department of Justice in the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit, but he's speaking to us today in his own personal capacity, not officially representing the Justice Department. But, Victor, tell me a little bit about, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of well-meaning ministries and organizations working to fight poverty. Are they accomplishing all they could? Have we just, is it simply because they've been unaware that this underlying problem is, you know, under undoing all the good they're doing.
You know, these ministries are and have been doing very, very important work for the poor, especially in the developing world. And one of the things that we want to emphasize in our book is not that we should do less of that. We should do more of that. Those ministries are actually doing such important work that it's too important to let that work be constantly undermined by the effects of everyday violence. And what we've seen is that over time, if you don't have a credible criminal deterrent to stop the bullies in the community, the bullies will just sweep in and take away the goods or block access to the services that the that poverty alleviation ministries are providing. So, for instance, you know, the medical clinic is of no use to the slave who can't get out of the brick compound to go see a doctor. A new schoolhouse is of no use to a girl who can't walk to school without being raped or who gets trafficked into a brothel. You can bring microloans and maybe purchase a new sewing machine, but that's of no use if police can simply just steal the proceeds from the new business. You can bring in new high-yield seeds or farm tools, but those are of very little use to the widow who has just now been thrown off her land. And even more powerfully, none of the medical clinics, schools, and microloans can stop the violence. And that's part of the reason why we have this image of the locust effect. The locust effect title comes from this episode in our own history where our own country had some very, very smart poverty alleviation or development programs. They were trying to create opportunities for people to move out to the Midwest and begin to put together a life. They had land grants and some loans to help them get started in the process. And essentially, these families would literally bet the farm on the success of their crops. All their materials, their little shelter, their farming tools were all mortgaged, and everything depended on being able to pay that debt with the proceeds of a good crop. And in 1875, it was looking very promising. It looked like it was going to be a very good year for the crops, and this bet might actually pay off. And then farmers looked up into the horizon, and they saw this dark cloud approaching. And it wasn't the cloud of a spring rainstorm. It was actually the largest plague of recorded locusts in history, a plague of locusts about 27 million tons of locusts, the size of the state of California, just descended on the Midwest and ate and devoured everything. And in a matter of hours, all these years of trying to plow and plant their way out of poverty were just wiped out. And it wasn't that the poverty alleviation programs weren't good or weren't smart. They were. They were very smart and helpful programs, but they couldn't stop the locusts. When the locusts came, they ate away all the benefits of all those programs in a second, and none of those programs could stop the locusts. And that's what we're seeing now in the developing world today. These are very, very important programs, poverty alleviation and public health programs and human rights efforts in the developing world. And they're just too important to let this bottleneck that comes from violence just choke out the efficacy of those efforts. So if we can wedge open that bottleneck, there are already wonderful ministries and resources that are available to help the poor thrive.
So how do we stop the locusts? I mean, how do you bring about justice when the rule of law isn't honored or enforced? I mean, isn't that kind of the main issue, that there doesn't seem to be any rule of law or sense of justice?
That's exactly right. That is the problem. And if you sort of look at just the modern human rights movement of the last 60 years, I sort of see it in three different stages. In the first stage, right around World War II, there was this effort to just get people to agree on what human rights are. And that was actually just this tremendous success, and we got the Universal Declaration of Human Rights out of that, and all the different kinds of violence that we're talking about were prohibited by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But the problem was it was just a piece of paper. These are just parchment promises. So then there was this sort of second movement to take these standards that were embodied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and actually embed them into national law, domestic law, where they could be enforced. And that political movement was also very successful. And that's sort of where we find ourselves today. Every abuse that we talk about in the book is actually against the law in the country where it's occurring. So as I was saying before, it's not that the poor don't get good laws. They do. The problem is that they're not getting the benefit of enforcement. Those laws were entrusted into utterly broken public justice systems that just fail to enforce the law on behalf of the poor. And so it's a bit like having this miracle vaccine that will cure all these people who are dying without it. The trouble is that the vaccine is sort of locked away in a warehouse, and there's no effective delivery system for getting the vaccines out of the warehouse and into the bloodstreams of the people who are dying without them. That does nothing to undercut the tremendous advance of creating the vaccine, but it does suggest this urgent new priority of actually building a delivery system that will get the vaccines out of the warehouse and into the bloodstreams of the people who are dying without them. And that's where we are today. The challenge, as you said, is actually creating public justice systems that will enforce the law on behalf of the poor.
Well, give us some examples of how that system is broken. I mean, from the number of policemen or judges or the language. Just I mean, you could spend the rest of the hour on that, but give us a few sort of examples of the confusion.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the most powerful parts of the book, because it's really hard for us to wrap our brain around how broken these systems are. And because when you go to the developing world, you'll see things that look like police and look like prosecutors and look like judges, but they just aren't functioning that way on behalf of the poor. And so that's why in Bolivia, for example, statistics demonstrate that if you sexually assault a child, you are literally more likely to die from slipping in the shower than ever being convicted of your crime. Or in India, statistics indicate that if you hold someone in slavery, you are more likely to be struck by lightning than ever sent to prison. And so as a result, violent people oppress the poor because they can. There is just no criminal cost to committing this violence against the poor. And because these systems are so broken, as the UN said, it's as though they're living outside the protection of the law. It's like they're living in this sort of lawless area where there really is no law enforcement in their area. And so they're utterly vulnerable to being preyed upon by the bullies in their community.
Because they can.
There's a book by a journalist named Catherine Boo. She's an immersion journalist, so she goes and she'll actually, for instance, live with the poor people in a community in the United States for several years, and then out of that experience, she'll write and describe what that's like. And several years ago, she did a similar immersion journalism project, but instead of it being in the United States, where many of her prior projects had been, she actually did it in a slum in India, just outside Mumbai. And in her book, which is called Behind the Beautiful Forevers, and it's a really eye-opening read, she describes what it's like to immerse yourself in this community for several years. And she was interviewed on NPR after her book came out, and the interviewer asked her, "You now have lived with these very poor communities, both in the United States and now also in India. Is there anything distinct that you have noticed about what it's like to be poor in India compared with being poor in the United States?" And without hesitation, she said, "The thing that stood out the most was the way that the poor interact with their law enforcement system. The poor in the United States, when they're in trouble, will still call 911. But in India, you don't run to the police, you run from them." And that was the striking difference for
Victor,
her.
We need to jump in, take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more in a moment about the locust effect with Victor Boutros here on Connecting Faith.
Now to the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired encore presentation.
You know, we have big hearts, as we should, hearts of compassion, as we seek to be the hands and feet of Jesus and to be where he would be, helping and caring for the poor. But The world's poorest communities have a plague of violence under the surface that has become routine, and it has ruined lives, blocked the road out of poverty, and undercuts development. We're talking about it today with Victor Boutros, who is speaking on his own personal capacity. But he is a member of the Justice Department's Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. He has co-authored with Gary Haugen from International Justice Mission the new book called The Locust Effect: Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. It's published by Oxford University Press, and it is important reading, and recommend it to you. And we were just talking before the break about just a few examples of some of the ways in which the system is broken. And, Victor, just sort of, you know, you just shake your head. You can hardly believe that, you know, in some countries there may be only be, what, one court clerk or a justice, or that, you know, court cases take months, and or it's in English and no one speaks English. I mean, give us a little sense of some of those examples.
Yeah. So one of the challenges for the poor in the developing world is they don't even get sort of the basic protections of law that we get in the United States. So, for example, I mean, really, the average poor person in the developing world has just never met a lawyer in his or her life. In the United States, there's about one lawyer for every 749 people. In the country of Zambia, by contrast, there's only one lawyer for every 25,667 people. And likewise in Cambodia, there's one for every 22,402 people. What that just means in practical terms is that there are more lawyers in the New York offices of some major law firms than there are in the entire country of Zambia or Cambodia. And then of these very small class of lawyers, prosecutors represent an even tinier subset. And some of them aren't even trained lawyers. And others, like the police, sometimes will extract bribes to drop cases. And so when cases are reported and referred for trial, there are often too few public prosecutors to handle the volume of it. In India, for example, experts have estimated that at the current rate, it would take 350 years for courts in Mumbai, India, to hear all the cases on their books. India has, according to the UN, about 11 judges for every 1 million people. So these are a lot of numbers, but I just say them to give you a sense of the true capacity challenges that exist for the developing world in actually delivering the enforcement of the law to the poor.
One of the things that caught my attention was that the system itself was set up not with the poor in mind, right? I mean, in parts of the world, particularly where the British Empire had a foothold.
That's true. Yeah, we talk about in the book, like, how did this actually happen? Why are these public justice systems so broken? And we talk about three different quite surprising reasons in the book why these public justice systems are broken. And one is, just as you say, it's not that there's sort of this blueprint and it's been poorly executed. I picture sort of this blueprint for a house, and the blueprint's good, but the builders do a poor job, and so it's just a rickety house. That's actually not the picture of what's happened in the developing world. It actually was just a different blueprint altogether. Instead of exporting the form of public justice that the British used in their own cities, in London, for instance, they exported a different kind of public justice altogether. In fact, it wasn't public justice at all. It was the police and prosecutors and courts were a system that were designed to protect those in power, the colonial powers, from the public, rather than to actually serve and protect the public. And what happened is, even though decolonization happened and there was this movement to change the laws to protect the poor, there wasn't any corresponding just movement to change the public justice systems that were never actually set up to protect the poor, but to protect those in power. And so in a sense, what happened is you just had a new person sitting in power. The colonial powers left, and the new indigenous powers took their place, but now they sat in the seat of a system that wasn't designed to serve the consumer public, but it was designed to protect those in power from the public.
And even the English language, right? And in fact, in some cases, what the 18th, 19th century English language.
Yeah, it's actually mind-boggling that you can actually, if you're a poor person in the developing world, and just to give you an example of one story, there's a young man in Africa who is protecting his little water well in his community. And an older gentleman comes and is trying to take water that was not his. And so there's a scuffle that ensues. And the police come, and the older gentleman brings a charge against the young man because he lost his hat in the scuffle. And so now this young man is charged with robbery with violence. And what you need to understand is that that's actually a capital crime in this African country. And so now this man, who speaks no English, is thrown in jail, and he's on trial literally for his life for this crime of robbery with violence. And he walks into court, and the court is entirely in English. There's no interpreter, and so now this gentleman is on trial for his life in a language that he does not understand. He speaks Swahili. He doesn't speak English. There's no interpreter. And so now you think, well, his lawyer will help with that. Well, he doesn't have a lawyer, and there's no system of providing lawyers for those who are too poor to afford them. So now you have a gentleman who's on trial for his life in a language he doesn't understand with no legal representation. And this, which sounds just so outrageous, is so unremarkable in this African community that it will never, ever make the papers. It will never even rise to the level of dinner conversation in the community. It's just that common.
And the possibility of someone being accused of something, being in a jail for months, perhaps years, right, without any opportunity for trial.
Yes, there's massive backlogs. Right now there's about 10 million people in the developing world today who are held in pretrial detention. What that means is that they're basically being held in jail and there hasn't been any charge or crime. So a police can just do an extortion sweep, go in and you do an extortion sweep and you can end up in jail. In fact, that's exactly what happened to a man named Caleb, who is walking his kindergartner to school one morning. And the police, who are under pressure to solve a crime in the community, come up on Caleb, and he doesn't have money for a satisfactory bribe to make them go away. And so just on the spot, they take him, they seize him, and throw him into jail, leaving his kindergartner open-mouthed on the street watching as this happens. And as a result, he's just stuck all of a sudden in jail for a year. And meanwhile, sort of the locusts of predatory violence descend onto his house, claiming that they're going to do a search. And next thing you know, all the money that he and his wife had been saving for their older daughter's education is devoured. And just like that, in a matter of hours, all these years of effort are gone. And the freedom and ability to earn money of the breadwinner in that home is stolen away, and he's thrown in this sort of disease-ridden prison in the developing world where he has no advocate and no voice.
Sobering stories from the book The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. And Victor, talk to me about, you know, those of us that, you know, get sort of, we get worked up. This definitely upsets you as you read it. But what can one person do? I mean, isn't this something that has to be done at the high levels of government? I mean, you're part of a government organization that's working. Is this something that people listening today could actually have an impact in?
Absolutely. In fact, this is one of the most striking things that I have learned just in my own journey with God, learning about His passion for justice, is that that God actually really cares about justice, and He is in the Scriptures the God of justice who calls us to walk humbly with Him and to do justice for the poor and the oppressed. And He doesn't give us a calling or a mission that He doesn't also equip us to do. And it's this all hands on deck proposition where literally every listener who's listening right now is called by God to be involved in the work of justice. And everybody can be involved in at least one of three ways. The first is to actually go to the Jericho Road, to go to these places of need, which typically for us in America means stepping a little bit out of our comfort zone, going to places that we aren't naturally going to go to unless we're actively looking for them, looking for those people who are in need and beginning to work in your community to serve them and help them. So we can go. Some of us will go overseas. Some of us will go to Jericho Roads in our backyard. But the second thing that we can all do is we can also send. People who end up going just don't go magically. They go because they're mobilized by good teaching and by resources, and that's something that we can be a part of. And the third thing that we can all do is pray. And I think that sometimes sounds like just sort of a nice spiritual add-on, but C.S. Lewis really helped me see the power of this. He says, really, there's two ways in which God has given us power to be involved in his work of making his kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And one is the work of our hands, and the other is prayer. And we tend to think that the work of our hands is really the more powerful of the two, but C.S. Lewis says, no, it's actually not. The work of our hands is limited by our own strength. It's limited by our geography. It's limited by in scope, but prayer is not. It's not limited by our strength. It's not limited by our own geography. It's something that we can actively do, and it calls on us to know what's happening in the world, to educate ourselves, to connect with these hard places, to connect with the man lying on the side of the Jericho Road rather than passing by. And yet it's this great privilege to see how God will work these miracles of justice when we start showing up with small acts of obedience.
In a moment, we'll hear from Victor Boutros about a couple examples of where change is taking place in some surprising situations. Positive change is happening to counteract the locust effect, why the end of poverty requires the end of violence. It's a book just out from Gary Haugen and Victor Boutros from Oxford University Press. Victor is a federal prosecutor and joining us today, works specializing in the area of human trafficking. More in a moment.
Thanks for joining us for the best of Connecting Faith. More in just a moment. Welcome back to an encore presentation, the best of Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. This is a previously aired program.
Over the past few weeks, I've been reading the new book from Gary Haugen and Victor Boutros called The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. It's unsettling, it's sobering, but there is some hope in the midst of it, and we're going to find out a little bit about that next. Victor serves as a federal prosecutor, and he is actually working on behalf of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's also a member of the Justice Department's Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. He's speaking to us today, though, in his own personal capacity, not as an official of the government. But, Victor, I'm wondering if we don't really like talking about this. I mean, if this hasn't gotten a lot of maybe discussion over the years simply because we prefer not to, dwell on the depravity of man. I mean, there is just there's no doubt about it. There's evil in the world, and you've seen it way up close and personal.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons why we struggle with that. One is that it tends to be hidden from view. It's something that's hard to see. And unlike shantyhouses don't hide themselves. But violent oppressors intentionally try and hide the violence from view. And in this sort of tragedy, often the victims feel this incredible shame and embarrassment from being victims of violence that they also want to hide it from view. So you have this almost tragic conspiracy where you have both the perpetrator and the victim trying to hide this violence from view. And so as a result, it's just hard for us to see. So I think on one end, we just sort of have this obliviousness to it. It's something that we just don't see. We're not on the Jericho Road. We're not seeing people on the side of the road. And then I think on the other side of the poor, on the other side of the line, is once we actually begin to hear this, I think we can just feel paralyzed. It comes in such an overwhelming fashion that we're sort of like the proverbial deer in headlights, where we just the lights of the car speeding down the road ought to be the very information that propels us to action, but it's just coming at us in such an overwhelming fashion that we feel our feet sinking into the concrete and find it hard to move. And so I myself have just found myself vacillating from poles of obliviousness on the one side to when I actually am learning about this, feeling paralyzed on the other side, and feeling like paralyzed because it feels like, oh, this is so tragic, but it's scary. This is not a benign system. It's a malignant system. Violence is kind of scary. Taking on violent liars in the world sounds really scary. And also, it feels sometimes just overwhelming and hopeless. And that's why in the book, we really spend some time taking this pivot toward hope, because in some sense, the last 45 minutes can just sort of be like, oh, you've just really – thanks, Vic. You've really just left me depressed for the rest of the day. So I do think it's really important to see how God is actually working. And for us, there's two kind of main ways that we talk about hope in the book. The first is sort of just the hope of history. And we tell this forgotten story of how many of the public justice systems in our own country, if you read about how they were just even 100 years ago, you would not be able to distinguish them from what we talked about earlier. It sounds just identical to the stories that you hear about public justice systems in the developing world today. And so what we take from that is that reasonably functioning public justice systems don't just fall from heaven. They typically do start out as brutal and corrupt. And then there's a fight that takes place to redeem the system. And that fight has taken place in places like New York and Chicago and L.A. and London and Paris and Tokyo. We share some of the stories of those transformations in the book. And we're starting to see those transformations happening in the developing world today. And that's really the second pivot towards hope, which is that it's not that there's been this huge effort to make developing world public justice systems work, and it's been found impossible. It's not that it's been found hard, or excuse me, it's not that it's been found, it's tried and been found impossible. It's that it's been found somewhat hard and just sort of left untried. We haven't really tried it. We can't find 1% of our aid in the developing world that actually goes toward making public justice systems work for the poor. And so, just to take one example, the Gates Foundation was very seriously interested in stopping the plague of HIV that was happening, especially in Africa. And so they go to Africa and they start these interventions, and they're troubled because they're feeling like maybe these interventions aren't having quite the impact that they had hoped. And one researcher in South Africa tells the story of how these interventions are really directed toward people who are making conscious and consensual choices about their sexual interactions. And yet there's this whole other category of people who aren't, these are victims of rape. They're not making an intentional choice about their sexual interactions. And none of the interventions will help them. And so Gates comes to International Justice Mission and says, look, we don't know how to stop this violence. Can you do this? And they give a grant, and they say, we want to see if you can actually prove that this will work. And so they pick a city, the second largest city in the Philippines. It's a place called Cebu. And they hire this third-party auditor to go in and do just sort of a baseline to figure out how much sex trafficking against children is taking place in Cebu. And just give us a baseline. And so they go and they do that, and Gates says, we want to see if within 4 years you can reduce victimization by 20% in this big city. And so IJM uses its method to try and make law enforcement stand up and enforce the law. And 4 years later, the independent auditors come back, and they document not a 20% reduction, but almost an 80% reduction in victimization of children in sex trafficking in Cebu. And so what we're seeing is that most of the violent liars in the world who are committing these crimes are actually cowards. And the moment you start turning up the heat, the moment you actually start enforcing the law, you discover that they'll leave the poor alone. Because the vast, vast majority of the crimes that we talk about are just crimes of opportunity. They're crimes of opportunity. They take place because there's really no risk of getting caught. And you just increase the risk a little bit, and crimes of opportunity drop like a rock. They really begin to plummet because it becomes all of a sudden becomes far too risky to actually prey on the poor. And so the hope is that we can begin to see more and more demonstration projects like the one in Cebu that will help transform the conversation around poverty and direct more resources toward enforcing the law in the public justice systems in the developing world.
One of the examples you give, which that's a great example, you also talk about the country of Georgia, and on a national level, some pretty significant changes there. Just share a little bit about that example.
So the country of Georgia in the early part of this millennium, just 10, 15 years ago, was actually rated. There's an index of corruption that sort of rates countries on their level of corruption. And the country of Georgia, which is a former Soviet part of the Soviet Union that then became independent, was more corrupt than any of the countries that where IJM works or that we describe in the book. So more corrupt than all of them. And when you read the book, you get a sense that, wow, there's a lot of corruption in these countries that we describe. Georgia is lower ranked than all of them. And so there's just a reform movement that rises up in Georgia. A new leader is elected. And the first thing that happens is they discover that one of the problems with their police force, one of the reasons why it's so corrupt, is because the police has just become essentially a criminal organization to extract bribes. And so people would actually pay $10,000 to get a job in the police force that pays roughly $10 a month. Why does someone do that? Why is someone paying $10,000 to get a job that pays $10 a month? Well, it's because you're extracting so much money from bribes and extortion in the community. And so as a result, there are just this proliferation of police in Georgia. It's almost like there's as many police as there are citizens. It's just a huge number of police relative to the number of citizens. So the very first thing they do is in a single day, they fire 16,000 police officers. And instantly, the city becomes much more safe. And they increase the salary of the police officers. They give them better training. There's more accountability. And in a matter of 7 years, Georgia goes from one of the most corrupt countries in the world to being less corrupt than the United States, the UK, and France. And as the head of state once said to Gary, he said, you know, corruption is not a culture. It's a choice. It's something that we can choose to stop if we really want. And that's encouraging to us, because really once you that has to be the starting point. You have to start with building a vetted police force that can actually begin to enforce the law. And to see that kind of transformation in such a short time is quite powerful.
The book ends on some hopeful notes and some ways that we can engage and do more. And it seems like, I guess, awareness is one of the first things. And as you said, Victor, a little bit of action, we can go, and we can certainly pray. All those things are valuable.
Absolutely. And I do think that there is this sort of – I've just experienced in my own life this joy of actually just sort of stepping out of the boat of certain competence into the sort of the choppy waves where Jesus is. And he is, I think, calling us to do that. And it's striking to see how Jesus spent so much of his time with those who were actually really in need. And I think he is inviting us to do the same and to experience the joy of being out of the boat with him and seeing him in his strength accomplish these miracles of justice through very small acts of obedience. And that is a great privilege to get to be a part of that.
And for the sake of the poor made in God's image, we do need to care for our brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
Victor, talk a little bit about the lotuseffect.com. That's the website. What will people find there?
So the locusteffect.com, it's actually just a great resource to actually connect more. So it's a place where you can go, you can find material to pray about, you can find material to learn more about what the locus effect is. You can find actually just very personal stories that help you connect more deeply with what's happening in the poor, and stories of hope. And in addition, there's just sort of one very practical way that each of the listeners can be involved and do something quite powerful for justice in the world in just a matter of a minute or two. And that is, there are these Millennium Development Goals, which are sort of the blueprint of the international community for beginning to address poverty in the world. And for the last 15 years, those goals have had virtually no mention of violence. And right now, they're in the process of creating a new blueprint for the next 15 years. And you can just go online and just sign an electronic petition at thelocusteffect.com, where you just say, like, to the UN, it's important that you focus on violence prevention. We want to see the locust effect end, because all these efforts are just too important to let them be swallowed and eaten away by the locusts of predatory violence. And you can do that just in a matter of minutes and begin to help the poor through your voice.
Lift your voice today to be a part of the hope that is available if we work together. Thelocusteffect.com is the website. The book called The Locust Effect. Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence, from Oxford University Press. Victor Boutros has co-authored it along with Gary Haugen from International Justice Mission. Victor serves as a federal prosecutor, investigates and tries nationally significant cases of police misconduct, hate crimes, international human trafficking around the country. On behalf of the U.S. Department of Justice, he spoke to us today in his personal capacity, and we're honored to have you on today. Victor, thanks for the good work and for raising your voice on this important issue.
Thanks. It's been a privilege.
If you missed part of today's program or want to pass it on to a friend, you can always listen to the podcast archives online. It's myfaithradio.com, and click on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith at myfaithradio.com. And join us for an important discussion tomorrow on Connecting Faith as we talk about spiritual awakening and revival in America. It's here on Connecting Faith.